All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 2 of Justice with Jax. And I am your host, Jacqueline Armendariz-Unzueta. You can call me Jax. And I am so very happy to have my colleague, friend, co-plaintiff, John Christiansen here with us today on the show. And so take it away, John. Introduce yourself.
Wow. Very good with the pronunciation, Jax.
Absolutely.
Armendariz.
John's practicing.
Also, thank I just you, wanted John. To get out there first thing. Fuck Modi. No.
That's an inside-ish joke.
It is an inside-ish joke. I'm so sorry to have started your podcast this way. What am I doing introducing myself?
It's only episode 2. Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself, your affiliations. For one thing, a big reason why you're on episode 2 is that you are, would you say, a co-founder and current board member of the Chinook Center, which is my co-plaintiff in Armendariz versus City of Colorado Springs.
Yes, that is what I am. Actually, I'm newly the executive director, I guess, of Chinook Center. So yes, thank you. So yes, I am one of the founders of Chinook Center. I run it mostly. I sort of do the boring day-to-day operations there, which is fine. I like doing it. I'm also a member of DSA. I helped.
For those who don't know, what does DSA stand for,
John? DSA is the Democratic Socialists of America, the Colorado Springs chapter of that national organization, the largest socialist organization in the country. I am also a member of United. I'm actually the president of our union,
United
Campus Workers Colorado. So, yes, I wear many hats.
But yeah, that's only a few of them, actually, right? Can I say one more and we'll come back to this later, but
you're
an academic. Is that right?
And I do have a
Give us an idea of your credential there.
Well, so I'm working on my PhD right now. I'm ABD, all but dissertation. Yay. So literally right now, not at this very moment, but I'm working on my dissertation, which is about looking at how garment worker unions interact with international organizations in Bangladesh.
It's beautiful.
Yes, it's excellent. Very fun.
Well, that is, I think, a great segue into kind of the purpose of this show, which I was reminding folks that we're kind of trying to strike a balance here. We have this significant civil rights case that we are co-plaintiffs in, Armendariz versus City of Colorado Springs, and we also want to keep community building. And one of the biggest things we've talked about, like, why a podcast? There's a lawsuit going on. Aren't you scared about talking about it? Is that's not really our style, actually.
Yeah, no, it definitely isn't. In fact, the day that we filed the lawsuit, I don't know if you watched it, Sean and I did a special episode of our podcast celebrating that we'd done it.
So, Just Cause.
Just Cause, our podcast. Check it out. We don't do it anymore, but still check it
there's
out on YouTube.
There's an archive.
Yes, there's a beautiful archive.
Yes.
So,
it's not our style to stay quiet. And so that's part of why the mission here is that telling the story, who could tell it better than us? It's our personal lived experience. And then, you know, a civil rights case has hopefully a profound positive impact on our society. And that's part of what's motivating us. And the thing is with that, that's a long process. Like, the journey has just begun because, ding, ding, today's 200 days since.
Yes, which I didn't even realize. You have been tracking this.
I am literally writing it down. Yes.
Since we filed.
Wow. Armendariz versus City of Colorado Springs was filed August 1, 2023, which is Colorado Day, August 1, right? So I always appreciated that. But so the idea is that we're sharing updates about the case, but also helping people kind of understand the process because it is so involved, right? Yeah. And we've been learning a lot together, actually.
So I even expected this to be kind of a long, involved process after having my own encounters with the law in the past. But this has been so much more.
It's a whole other dimension, isn't it?
They even warned us. They were like, this could go on a few years. I'm like, okay. But it's just, it's amazing to see all of the maneuvers, the maneuvering that, you know, the city and the FBI and the cops use themselves.
Absolutely.
It's disturbing.
Right. And on that note, you know, some of what we talked about with episode one with our colleague Sean Walls is that so much to learn, and yet sadly there's some familiarity to so we're gonna get into that a little bit as well, but another interesting update that I wanted to share and would love to hear from you if you have thoughts too, John, is that we have a new judge on our case, basically, because it's in U.S. District Court, right? Because it's a civil rights case. And for me, you know, at the time CSPD and the FBI came after me, I was a U.S. Senate staffer, right? So all of this is very interesting to me. It's something I track. And in past lives, you know, early in my career, I was a newspaper reporter and I covered the crime beat. I covered courts. And so doing FOIA requests or other records requests is fun for me, right? I'm one of those people.
See how it's all come full circle for you.
We love full circle moments, don't we? Truly. And so that being said, my time, you know, the privilege I had to serve as a federal staffer, always hearing about judge confirmations and stuff like that, that frankly, you know, as the average person, why the hell would that matter to you, right? Like, it seems just, you know, a lot of the governmental minutiae. But for me, this lived experience we're having is like, that's why all these things matter.
Yes.
Because Judge Cato Cruz is a newly appointed U.S. District Court judge, and obviously their dockets are full, so a bunch of cases just were moved to his new court. And I just looked him up a little bit. It's really cool. You can find what judges have written before, their opinions on things. And turns out he's from Pueblo. So I don't know if you've done any research on your end, John, or have any thoughts about that development, because I found it an interesting one.
Well, no, not – I mean, again, it's just part of that, all those machinations or whatever that
– It's a machine,
are part of this. But, you know, I have to say, you're talking about the minutia. As I've done activism for longer and longer, I get more and more interested in the minutia. The details are what I find are what's so important.
You can't dismiss them, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
because, you know, like, whatever, I
want
to focus on the big ideas.
Yeah.
But then you realize, like, oh, my God,
everything
is in the details.
The devil's in the details.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see, like, well, and you mentioned the judges. This is one thing that actually Sean and I have talked.
Judges matter so much.
Judges are so important, and I think we learned this with, well, whatever.
We've
we should have learned
so
this a long time ago
over.
With Republicans. Yes.
Yeah.
And then, like, Trump putting in so many judges and, like, seeing how that can affect our entire country.
Yep.
But also seeing how judges can just sign off on any old search warrant. And we saw
that
this with, like,
that
has
to do with our case. Yes.
Exactly. I don't think they really read them. And we saw this with the, what was it, the FISA court? The federal terrorism court,
right?
They were just signing off on cases.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this idea that judges just, it seems like they just trust and believe whatever the cops tell them, which
oh,
is
yeah. That's
something
a pervasive thing in our society,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
And
that the police are like,
bad news. The cops lie.
Cops are liars. That's
quite
what they do.
That's
their MO, I would say, in fact. And so, yeah, I think it's important that we really do start paying attention to these judges and even magistrates, which I don't, until this case, I hadn't really thought about
that?
Magistrates. I had a magistrate
yeah.
in a case one time
yeah.
in Pennsylvania. I was like, is this like a Pennsylvania thing? But yeah, these are all really important things that come up
yeah.
that we should be paying more attention to. And tracking the judges and seeing what they're saying. So like, you know, the judge that so-called, I think.
Oh, the judge in my case.
Yes,
yeah.
that released that body cam.
Shout out to her.
Yes, I want to give her props for doing that when like, Judge Ramirez.
We should write a nice letter about her.
We should.
Yeah.
At the city court.
At the municipal court.
Yeah, the municipal court.
The problematic judge, we could say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I looked him up, and he just has a business background.
Interesting.
Like business law.
Yeah.
And so he's making decisions on these cases that involve undercover cops and First Amendment rights, which,
yeah.
whatever, like well, he's a judge, I get,
uh-huh.
but he really doesn't have a background in any of this.
Yeah.
So it felt to me like he didn't have a sense of the import of this,
fair
you know,
enough.
Like how heavy this was.
Yeah. Well, let's break it down for people because that's a great way to help people understand. We've touched on this is that there's a long history that's the context of this case, but some of the meat of it is that there were six people arrested. We're going to talk about for what in a second here. But that means that some of the cases were in municipal court or
right.
the city court level, which included yours. And mine was in our district court or
right.
fourth judicial
Charles,
district.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Charles and myself. Yes. And so why John is bringing this up and why this is important is because we hear the concept of you know, two different justice systems, or I say legal system. Justice is questionable
right,
in these systems.
Injustice system.
And so that was a major factor, and it's something Sean and I talked about because even my criminal attorney at the time, which again, shout out Chinook Center for making sure I was supported and defended, didn't want to engage with municipal court. She called it like a kangaroo court, just kind of a joke.
It is a joke.
yeah. And We had four people as a result of the protest that this case largely centers around in municipal court for different charges. And ultimately, though, there were never any actual convictions, and those charges, you know, were pretty, were like misdemeanors and things like that, right?
Like citations, like what you'd get for...
Mm-hmm. There was, like, you know, obstruction of a passage or something like that. And so, ultimately, to your point, what you mentioned is there are these municipal violations, again, misdemeanors that... somehow the FBI and like an undercover cop and all these taxpayer supported law enforcement actions were really targeting us for nothing other than our political speech. And so let's break this down a little bit further, which I think is an important concept for people to understand, is that my claims in this case are technically different than the Chinook Center's because I'm an individual person, and a lot of it has to do with them violating my Fourth Amendment rights or my privacy with the search warrants in my specific case. But John, do you mind talking a little bit about how that differs from what the violation was for Chinook Center?
Yeah, so ours is also a Fourth Amendment case, but I think this is an important point to raise because, you know, I talk to people all the time and there's this idea, I think, that people think that a lot more things are actually illegal for the government to do than actually are.
Like that spying stuff that sounds just
like
terrible.
People hate, like, the idea that, like, a cop can just, like, spy on political activists, not actually illegal. If they say there's,
that's not technically what the claims are about in this case,
right? Exactly. Yeah. That's not. When we brought this to so many different lawyers and the ACLU, they're like...
Yeah,
You know,
it took about 2 years for us to get traction.
And which is important because people, they're like, this is really messed up.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily illegal, which is, I think most people would find that to be bonkers.
Yeah, it's going to bother people.
Yes.
Your average person.
Like, which is like why it's important that, you know, like the Indy ran the article about it originally, and then Trevor.
And that was well before the ACLU case had been filed. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes.
And then Trevor
Aronson. And it was focusing on the spying.
Exactly. And that's the thing, too. There are so many elements to this case. Whenever I try and explain this to people, they're like, wait, what?
it's that meme with the guy with the red strings on the wall.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And then their face is that meme of the lady that's like just looking confused. If this was a video podcast, we could maybe pull
it up. We are doing video. Yeah.
What? Am I being videoed right now? You didn't tell me about it. Are you CSPD?
Right there.
What?
Mean to re-trigger that. No. Yeah.
So where was I? So yeah, that was all important, and I think most people are disturbed by that, but that really wasn't what was illegal.
Yeah.
But what the ACLU did find, at least as a strong claim, was again the Fourth Amendment violations, which is the unreasonable search and seizure,
right,
which they had. So basically after the housing rights protest had happened, the CSPD got into Chinook Center's messages, which is funny when you look at Discovery, the messages they're seeing. One of them is like, I have a bunch of Enfamil.
Oh, yeah.
Could you guys take this as a donation?
Baby formula?
Yeah, baby formula. Mm-hmm. And we're like, of course we'll take that as a donation. It's just things like that. So it's like,
part
of the reason I've thought about this, part of the reason I think they did do that is because I had made a call on my Facebook, which I'm sure is also under observation, to
no doubt about it.
to send videos of the altercation
right.
to the Chinook Center Facebook page.
The altercation that took place during this July 2021 housing march, which is specifically what probably you're referring to when they dogpiled Sean.
Yeah, when they came at us. Specifically, we're like, Sean Walls, you're under arrest, you know.
Well, that's why Sean was episode one, because all the documents in my case were mostly about Sean.
Yeah, which was wild. Which I'm glad that we got your discovery for that very reason. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's helpful to see, like, when people get arrested, like, what they're doing, because obviously we already suspected this. We already, you know, we discovered the undercover cop. But finding a place where you can actually sue the government, and the funny thing is, well, it's not funny, it's disturbing, is that they're trying to say, you can't sue us. You can't sue us at all.
The qualified immunity question, yes.
So it's like we tried so hard to find a place where we could sue them, and now they're still making the argument that the case should be thrown out because of qualified immunity, mm-hmm. which, you know, I don't know if who's listening or if they're familiar. Yeah, I guess the courts will decide. I don't know. I don't think they have a strong claim, but I'm not a lawyer.
Right. We leave it. At least we've got the ACLU on it. Yes. Like, that makes me feel confident. Yes. And
I believe the ACLU tends to take cases that they think that they can win.
I think most lawyers do.
Right.
That not all cases, obviously, that's a different conversation. But no, so I appreciate that. So the claims that I have as an individual, I would say, like, are a little bit wider than what Chinook Center has been limited to because of that it's an organization.
Yeah. And what's disturbing about that is, you know, you're able to make these claims about, like, oh, this affected my mentality and everything like this. Mm-hmm. But Sean has been so screwed because of this.
Yeah.
And, like, I know that myself and Sam have all lost sleep over this. This hung over us for, you know, it still hangs over. It's a little less of a thing now. Mm-hmm. It's a little less heavy now. But for a year, it just kind of hangs over you.
Every single person who was arrested with regard to this.
Yes, you're very aware of this constantly, and you're aware that, like, the police are spying on you, then they're arresting you, and then, you know, you get these documents and you see what they're doing. It's pretty heavy, so it is unfortunate that we as individuals couldn't also sue them for these things because, you know, and this is sometimes what I get frustrated with when I talk to people about the legal system who clearly have no idea because they've never experienced the legal system and how limited claims can be in the legal system, because people think you can just sue for anything, right? But you have to limit your claims to specific
things. Access as well, because I think it's important in our story to call out, like, it took us time to get to the point where the ACLU would pick up this case. And then, thankfully, you know, we have the privilege of that kind of representation.
Yes.
What about all the people who neither of those applies to their very valid experience?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So that's part of why, like, it's a strange experience. Weird is the word for me, like, literally my name on the case so much bigger than me or us, and just trying to honor the fact that we want this to have a positive impact for our community, but it looks like that'll take some time.
I do want it to eventually, you know, that is our goal. We want to, this is just another part of activism. Right.
Yeah.
We want to change things through this as well. It's not my favorite way to do things, going through the legal system, because it doesn't feel empowering.
It's not very satisfying a lot of the time, unfortunately. Yes.
But it will be when we win.
There we go. When we win.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the idea here. And so right now, what I had explained in the other episode too, is that we actually don't have a trial date set, and we're in the phase of what's called limited discovery. And a lot of that is related to this kind of legal question that's come up regarding qualified immunity. And so, but some of the things that we have been able to access, and I let people know that another interesting process piece of this was we have to actually keep some of it confidential, and we signed what's called a protective order, right, about that. But some of the things we can talk about, because by virtue of this public civil rights case, litigation, and some public record, right? And so in our early documents that we've seen, maybe you got a chance to read, it was like a very short, but it's like an FBI memo. I've mentioned this to you. And so it is really the strangest experience to have, like, an FBI memo and reading your name in it, and, like, you know, they've got my DOB and Social Security number. Thankfully, they kindly redact that sort of thing when these are released.
What's
funny
is how inconsistent their redactions are, though.
Good point. And for me, what really stood out about this document was, like, seriously, a couple of things. But one is that it's dated before my arrest, which occurred about two weeks after the protest.
Oh, what's the date on it?
The date is August 6th. And so it really raised a red flag for me, which, bit of an inside joke there. We'll talk about that red flags later. But was that I was actually kind of, like, were my feelings hurt a little bit? Maybe, because they referred to me as not an individual prominent within a domestic political organization.
And what was it called? A SIM?
So what the SIM is in reference to, the FBI was trying to determine whether what occurred with me, which was, you know, a false allegation from CSPD that I had tried to hurt an officer. They were determining whether it was a sensitive investigative matter.
Right, whether or not you were Trump. Or,
yeah. Thank you. Yeah, an insurrectionist or something. But basically they said it was not a SIM. Like, there wasn't significance. She's a nobody. And then they listed the other charges that happened, which were all basically, all except for, I think in the case of Nathan, they were all like, the city ordinance misdemeanors, and yeah, this is like an FBI memo, right?
Yeah,
and
so
I want, yeah, I want to check in with you, like, what you thought reading that, and then this is a two-part question for you, so put your sociology professor hat on, is how much has this spoken to you as it relates to America's history with things like COINTELPRO? So your thoughts on seeing us in this FBI memo, and then how this is a reflection of America's history.
Yeah, so I mean, it's weird because as a left-wing activist, you're always like aware that these things can happen, right? You are aware of
you
the history.
You know it, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And then
it's you.
And then people are like telling you, and then, you know, you see the discovery and there's like hints of things here and there, but I have to say, when I read that it was like, what was it, Sean Walls and other leaders of Chinook Center are being investigated for domestic terrorism. Like, when it was written in black and white, it was a little bit more jarring for me that it was an FBI memo, because the city has always just kind of like ignored or denied sort of this terrorism thing. And everybody just kind of like tiptoes around it. Nobody really says, like, I mean, literally at Charles's hearing where his attorney was asking, do you think Charles is a terrorist? Do you think Chinook Center is a terrorist? You know, they were tiptoeing around. They're like, we're not going to answer that question.
Right.
And so you have this sense, but then it's like, yep, there it is.
They
said
it
right
there. They put
it in writing. They think we're domestic terrorists, which is bonkers, because where's the probable cause for that? I mean, I would like to think that we're really important too, like to the federal government.
My own
government.
Delusions of grandeur were injured.
That, like, the federal government's like, these people are like a threat to national security. But like, I really understand that, like, I don't really think we're that great of a threat to national security. sadly, you know.
Well, that's the very important distinction too that I think will be revealed in this case is, and this is where we want to talk the history stuff, and even in more modern times, how it relates to the Patriot Act, which is kind of this bullshit of, and we saw it in this case, where in the write-ups against us, we wore red, and so we were commies, right? Like, willing to die for the cause. Just like fever dreams from the MAGA side of things, right? Because Antifa is everywhere. All that ridiculousness, and yet we actually do have white supremacist domestic terrorists who had an insurrection at our Capitol. Mm-hmm. And so we're operating in, to me, it's honestly a kind of painful context, but it's also very motivating, because what our lived experience is people like Trump are trying to bastardize that and say it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And yet we stand for completely opposite things, right?
Yeah.
And so tell me your thoughts on all that, John.
So it's sometimes, it's frustrating to me that, you know, I remember when Biden got into office and he kind of like sicked the FBI on people. I was like, not too comfortable with this. It never just stays there, you know? And I was like, stop celebrating this. You know, and eventually we did see it. We see that, like, the FBI is still just investigating quote unquote Antifa or whatever. And what is it? Black identity extremists and these sorts of organizations. But, you know, the FBI has been recently kind of held up by liberals. And I'm like, the FBI has this horrible history. Maybe you guys need to read the history books.
Did
and
you
not
know
just
the letter they wrote to Martin Luther King Jr.? That's for one. That one blew my mind. And, like,
I can't remember. I know I've heard of it, but I can't remember the details.
I'm going to put a link in the podcast. But, yes, the FBI has a sordid history, we'll say,
right? Exactly, of trying to destroy movements for mm-hmm. change.
Well, let's segue that into, I think what you could very well speak on is really that reflection of how this relates to the past again, and things like COINTELPRO, because not only what it was it spying, but it was the idea that they could infiltrate communities getting organized and cause distrust mm-hmm. and disrupt the organizing because people power works.
Right, exactly. And really, this has a much longer history than COINTELPRO, to be honest. I don't want to like get into like 19th century European history. So I'll start.
But you could.
So, but you know, they had all the European governments had spy networks that were spying on the commies and the anarchists. And, you know, we see that coming to the United States too. In the early 20th century, we had what were called red squads in most major American cities that were basically their job was to monitor communists, socialists, anarchists, kill them, disrupt their organizing, things like this, right? And basically the FBI started as a result of those things. So the history of the FBI, the history of federal law enforcement is basically just a history of trying to disrupt and destroy left-wing movements for change.
And maybe the needle shifts just so slightly that it doesn't all focus on leftists, and
every once in a while they'll like, you know, get like a white supremacist in there, or they'll
every
get
once
like
in
some
a while.
Yes, exactly. But then and then in the 1970s we witnessed COINTELPRO because of some great activists that exposed it. And then, you know, Congress was like, we passed a law so they can't do this anymore. But I think I personally never believed that to be true.
Well, here we are today.
You probably right? did. Exactly. And so it's like, you know, COINTELPRO as a program is technically dead, but their mentality, the mentality of federal law enforcement agencies and local law enforcement agencies just hasn't really changed.
And how about this? For people who aren't as familiar with that term, keeping your professor hat on, COINTELPRO.
Okay,
break it down
for them? Yeah, so in the 19... Again, like I said, it had this history from the red squads of cities. But in the 1960s, the FBI started this program called the Counterintelligence Program, which their goal was to disrupt student, left-wing, and black activist organizations to stop what they called the Black Messiah, right? And so they targeted the Black Panthers. They targeted the Communist Party USA. They targeted SD, all these different organizations, right? And we know now, as a result of these documents, originally that just we found a little hint of it when some documents were stolen by some college students.
Right?
Yes, exactly. This is why it's so important to get those. They stole some documents from an FBI office and saw this COINTELPRO thing, and then eventually sort of like came out through the press. They got more access to those documents that show that the FBI was using these like dirty tactics too, where it wasn't just like they were, you know, arresting them. They were doing like really dirty things, like starting rumors and organizations that like so-and-so is sleeping with so-and-so, creating infighting. Exactly. Which I gotta say, I don't think we've ever healed from, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. Like our movements are still so paranoid as a result of the 1960s. And I honestly, like, I know this is a longstanding thing, like we're always like factional or whatever. But I think part of the reason it's still so hard to get organized is because we have these memories of this happening. So we have this fear and this paranoia that, like, you know, the spooks or whatever are hiding just around the corner, or they're in our organizations trying to disrupt things constantly. So it makes organizing that
and
much
then
harder.
Cases like this
come out, exactly.
You know, validate those fears. And it's something Sean and I talked about, that, you know, one of the difficult outcomes from this, out of many, the impact that the spying from CSPD had was that we had a tenants union. And that's one of the points that really pisses me off. We're going to have much more time to talk about what pisses me off. But the fact that the officer, right, April Rogers, was involved with the tenants union is particularly troublesome, in that effort was to protect people from slumlords, landlords.
Yeah.
And what more could you say about what you saw? I mean, you were very close to seeing the impact, because Chinook Center was really the organization that kind of broke the news, you know?
Right, right. Well, and I think what several of the tenant union organizers have pointed out is that they were finding, you know, people breaking the law.
Yeah. Yeah, and the irony.
Yes, they were finding landlords were breaking the law, and the police weren't responding to those things. They were still just in the organization trying to, for some reason, take down the tenant union,
right?
I guess, you know?
And related to that, the honeypot context of that, which if you want to talk on that, I think you have more details than I do on that, because to me that was another thread, another layer of them trying to fracture and trying to entrap people, trying to manufacture crime to make their jobs relevant.
Right. Well, and she also was participant in a factional dispute within the Chinook Center because she had joined so many different groups. She had joined, you know, you can't really join Chinook Center as an individual, I guess, but she was present at Chinook Center, donated things to Chinook Center, had joined DSA, had registered to vote with her, you know, fake identity.
Oh, yeah, the voting crime that was committed, that'll never be prosecuted. Yeah, I stand by that. Come for me for that one, please. Try me.
So she was in DSA, tenant union, the mutual aid union. Like, she got into all these different organizations, and then, she ensured that there was, like, I don't know if she ensured, but she helped with the tension that was that happened there.
She contributed to attention.
She contributed, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, she invited people from different groups, young men mostly, from different groups.
Hence the honeypot.
Yeah, exactly. Over to her apartment. And I'd heard about this like when we first started getting an inkling of there being this undercover cop. Mm. We started talking to people, and it slowly started to dawn on me this is what was happening. Mm-hmm. And then once Trevor came out and started investigating more, we found out more. She would invite people over to her apartment to try and get them to buy, or I guess buy, usually.
She was trying to entrap people with felonies for firearm crimes, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and, because there's the feed the FBI something, right?
Yes, exactly. Because the FBI is, the FBI was on the case, whatever the case was, for some reason.
The Joint Task Force.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Which still, that new document doesn't explain what it is that got them to case that could possibly still exist.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, people in Colorado Springs are too smart for that. Most of the people we talked to were
kudos to everyone for,
because you hear about these happening in other places, like Denver, for example.
Yeah,
but even throughout history, they get tricked. I even read an article a few years ago, maybe a couple years ago, about a woman that married an undercover cop in Britain.
Oh,
so they
had
this whole life together.
Yep. Yep.
So yes,
there are
luckily,
stories like that. Yeah.
So luckily, we were a little smarter than that in Colorado Springs. Nobody got married to an undercover cop.
Kudos.
Yes. That we know of.
So fun.
And also, I guess, congratulations if so.
You're so kind, John. Yeah. Point is, there's so many threads to this disturbing, right? And that's why, to me, this podcast, again, is so important. Because for me, being the person representing and my experience and how it fundamentally changed my view on the world, I got major trust issues now. At least I'm an abolitionist out as a result. The impact is far and wide, I guess is part of what we're trying to say. And so you mentioned Trevor, who we mentioned last time too, which is kind of part of the timeline, in that he was the reporter for The Intercept, right, which is like a national digital publication, and they have notoriety for working with Edward Snowden when he did his thing. And so
they're very civil liberty oriented.
And so I think I'm always grateful for the fact that Trevor did his job well and really,
unlike our local media, who has really just not
completely
done,
dropped
aside
the ball.
From Heidi Beadle, they've really not.
That's been another very disturbing part of this for me, and we'll strike a balance here, and we'll talk about some good community things too. But there's a lot of disturbing things about this case. And another one that occurred to me as you were kind of talking about what we experienced is finding out, again, this contrast of you are a terrorist when you don't represent what my political beliefs are, and how that is played out in Colorado Springs, because we later found out that the individual who murdered people at Club Q, the timeline of them first kind of popping on local law enforcement's radar, as well as the Fourth Judicial District Attorney's Office, is right along with our timeline of prosecution.
Happens at the same time,
and
exactly.
How, for me, that's so painful. My friend's boyfriend was one of the murdered individuals, Raymond Green, and to later process that I was being, it was the darkest time of my life. I'd never been to jail before. Here I was accused of a second degree felony by CSPD, really in retaliation for my political beliefs and who I am. That was an entirely unexpected layer to this, obviously, that cut me really profoundly deep, because it really felt that our DA, our law enforcement, did wrong there for obvious reasons. And they tried to jump and be like, dance around it and be like, well, that was the sheriff working that first busted the shooter. So CSPD didn't have.
But
like,
then, you know, like at the time, his mom did live in the city. So the city did have some role in investigating this as well. So it's like, yes, I understand that, like, the sheriff's department, but the FBI was made aware of this person.
Right.
And that they just kind of were like, meh. And he was literally like telling people, this is what I'm going to do. I have all the weapons for this. And like,
but
nothing
because
came
he
of
was
it. Yes.
Aligned with white supremacist domestic terrorists, he did not face the same scrutiny that we did, that he wasn't prosecuted at all. And I know the DA has danced around the facts of that matter, as far as I'm concerned as well. But, you know, what are your thoughts on kind of the layers of impact, and that being another one that we could never have possibly expected?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it's just like the juxtaposition of those two things, like in time too, is just, it's just wild to think about that this guy was telling the world that, like, I'm going to like be a mass shooter. Mm-hmm. And the FBI is like,
let's get these guys who do a food pantry instead.
And it really
instead.
Goes back to, too, when you read Sumi or Summy, I like Sumi personally. When
that's
you read,
the detective
that's the detective who
wrote like the warrants against myself and other prosecution, mm-hmm. or I guess documents used in prosecution.
Yes, and he's popped up in a lot of different sort of investigative documents as part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
And he was deputized.
Yes. And what
by
you
the
really
FBI,
get is
right?
like these are his views. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody's really vetting him. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of those documents that we got were, like, talking to his supervisor. Yeah. The supervisor's just assuming that this guy knows what he's talking about.
And
this isn't
so clearly
being seen through his own political lens. But it
Which
clearly
is. Which
is
so glaringly obvious. And, well, I remember, you know, it meant the world that I was able to go to Chinook Center during this incredibly difficult time. And that was part of our strength, that we worked together immediately. We didn't let them fracture us, totally. And I just remember reading like the arrest warrant for me and us like laughing because it was just so fucked up.
Yeah, it was just ridiculous.
And like, there's like three phrases that I feel like really triggered them. And to me, this is like white fragility on steroids. And this is how damaging it can be when you're a bully with a badge, right? But mm-hmm. they were mad at us because we believe Black Lives Matter, because housing is a human right. And particularly in my case, saying that white supremacy is domestic terrorism, because it hurt to read, you know, in theory, this person lives in my community too. Like, we're neighbors, right? And it hurt to read that this person was accusing me as a second degree felony, because when I dropped my bike, that must have meant I was trying to hurt this white man, because I know that white supremacy is domestic terrorism. And that was a pretty dark, like, sort of laugh to keep from crying moment
exactly.
where you're like, this guy, what?
Yeah.
So how did you process those things as we started to kind of unravel this? And
well, it gets at that thing too, that again, he's just seen this through his lens. I think most people understand that, you know, using the word, the letters YT, like A, if you've spent
the
any
internet
time
abbreviation
on, yes, if you've spent any time on the internet, you know that that's used to like get around sort of algorithm issues that, and things like
that
this.
That actually scrub speech.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the fact that he's sort of, and saying that like, oh, he's, that you attacked this cop who like was white, so he, you know, she hates white guys or whatever.
He basically, he wrote that like deliberately that he, like, yeah, I hate white
yes,
men
exactly.
because I say.
But again, it's that lens. Most people understand that it's like, that's not what, when people criticize white supremacy and it gets to that like sort of white fragility thing, like
yeah.
Sumi was like, how dare you? Like, he really
his
took that
hurt.
Personally, and he just sounded like so many like other like MAGA types too with that. That
yeah,
like really take this like intensely personally. Like, we can imagine why they take it so personally. Probably mm-hmm. because they're like racists. But you know, like
might be a factor.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how dare you call me out on my racism? But most people don't see that and react that way. But he's like yeah. clearly an intensely political
well,
dude.
And he took it to a whole nother
yes.
level because as a result of that, he essentially manufactured crimes. And in my case and Charles in district court, like the Fourth Judicial mm-hmm. is complicit in that because then they chose to prosecute
yeah,
us.
Yeah, and you see too that like what, because we obviously know that they were targeting us for a long time. And this is what's so funny is that they like finally got us on jaywalking.
You know?
And I get what, and resisting arrest, I guess. But like, they were trying so hard, and you get this when you put all these documents together, they were trying so hard to get us on something. Mm-hmm. And so when they saw an opportunity for this bike dropping mm-hmm. to be categorized as a crime, they're like, ah, this is it. We got it. We finally got a big one. We can get an attempted right. assault on a police officer, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like,
yeah.
you sort of got wrapped into it this way because.
They needed something
so badly
yeah.
to justify well, all of these resources that they were spending for so long. So mm-hmm. they're like, we got this.
And I don't think it helped my case with them kind of targeting us and me, in being that I worked for the senior senator of Colorado at the time. I think, again, it kind of fed their fever dreams of like Antifa's everywhere. And I very distinctly felt a sensation of like this overkill. You see this FBI memo where she's like, she's a nobody, and then they came for me, abducted me from my home, took all my electronic devices, left me in a blackout mode. So if I'm a nobody, why are you spending all these resources doing that, other than what, to retaliate against
me? Well, that's
why
they can do it to you, because you're a nobody. If you were somebody like a big political person, they might actually face bigger
repercussions, for the future, John.
Right? Yes.
Yes.
But that's
good
what they
point.
Want. I mean, they want to operate well, in secrecy, too.
And I think it was, to me, I profoundly felt it was a message of, oh, we're going to teach you.
Yeah, that's exactly what it
yeah.
was. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of why I'm so grateful to have the ACLU representing us. They're so thoughtful and responsive. And that's another piece that's coming out in this case, the truth of, like, this was retaliation. And
yes.
there's a pattern in practice. That's something I'm also really proud of with this case
yes.
is that with it, we've been able to kind of bring forth these other stories where maybe they didn't have like a civil rights claim,
right.
but it wasn't okay what happened.
Yeah, I completely
you've noticed
agree.
That?
That's what I wanted to get at was like, we know, mm-hmm. you know, and this is what Charles's attorney was trying to do too, which I really appreciate because she was Charlie Day in the picture, you know, with all the red strings.
Yeah.
But not all of the facts were quite there. Mm-hmm. And you could see that she was getting so frustrated that she, like, I remember in court, she's like, there's a conspiracy here. And I'm trying to show it, but they're doing everything they can to block access to information that would prove it, obviously.
Yeah.
Right? And so this, being able to get the ACLU case to start moving forward, we do start to get more pins and more threads connecting things more so, which
right.
is exactly what I wanted to do, because we know, like, if you live in this community and you do any degree of left-wing activism, you obviously know that there's a pattern and practice that CSPD is following of targeting and harassing
either you've
left-wing
experienced
activists.
It or someone you care
yeah,
exactly.
about has experienced
exactly. it.
Exactly. And you just kind of, I don't know, there's like a vibe or a sense or whatever that you get it. You're like, right, of course, there's an undercover cop, you know.
Yeah. Well, I after I was arrested, I ran into like a friend of a friend, and I told them what happened to me. I had never met them before, and they described something similar happening to them, and I was like, no.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, flash forward, at least again, we have this moment where we can like press accountability for that, you know, pattern and practice. And so That being said, we're getting here closer to the hour mark, and I want to give time to add that balance that we talked about, is that the good stuff. There's actually good things happening in our community, and like we touched on in this case, I think kudos to us, we kept growing together and moving forward together. So what's good right now with Chinook Center and any other efforts going on that you've been working on?
Right. I do say kudos to us as well.
Yes.
Very good. Yeah, what's funny is I remember right afterwards in DSA and in Chinook Center, I know we were all like very paranoid.
How could
yes,
all of
every
us,
single new person
lost
that walks
our sense
through the
of
door.
Safety.
Yes, exactly. And you know, I know DSA kind of went through a difficult time and Chinook Center kind of went through a difficult time. We actually saw our donations significantly drop off. We saw people stop participating in things. We were attacked by other members of the community. Mm. But I have to say, within the last, like, maybe year, I feel like things are going well. And what this has done, and I think I pointed this out when the podcast first dropped, mm-hmm. Colorado Springs dealt with this really well. Mm-hmm. Us as activists, I don't think we overreacted. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like, we could do everything better. But we didn't overreact.
Hindsight 2020.
Yes, exactly. We stuck together. We didn't like start pointing fingers at everybody.
We really stuck together.
Yes.
That's what I'm most proud of, because if we hadn't been together, we wouldn't have been able to put the pieces together because they
exactly.
were in different places.
Exactly.
And then the video that came from my case was a huge break. And we even had the municipal judge say, like, we've never seen people so organized before, right?
Yes.
Do you remember that? How disturbing
I mean,
that is, kind of weird.
It is nice, though, because we are organized. And, not to, like, pat myself on the back, but Chinook
you
Center,
should.
I think, is part of – oh, well, thank you. Chinook Center is part of that, and that was sort of the dream of Chinook Center, is to mm-hmm. have this community of solidarity where we could work on things together. We're not all doing the exact same thing, right? But we at least are sort of sharing
we're
information.
We're communicating, collaborating.
Yes. Like, and we're like a community. Like, a community yeah. isn't people that share all the exact same things, right? But you sort of share enough similarities that you can come together. So I just think it's been great. You know, we just recently opened as a warming shelter. And while it was difficult, we did a really good job with it. We had a lot of volunteers come together
That's
to do
awesome.
That.
Yeah.
We've gotten so many donations lately because I think people... Even the city who, like, clearly hates us, I think one thing that even our enemies see is, like, they stick to shit. They stick
consistent.
To their guns. They're very consistent. They're not going away. And, like, Sam and John
you know
and I
part.
Always joke about this, too, that, like, all we wanted to from the Chinook Center was, like, when the city was going to do something, they wanted to, like, consider, well, how's Chinook Center going to respond to this,
yeah.
react to this. And in some ways, I think that's true. I think
yeah.
the fact that, and I don't want to say it's just Chinook Center, it's the left-wing community has become so organized.
Yeah. Well,
that,
Chinook's an umbrella, really, for
yeah,
like
exactly,
a lot.
Exactly, for all of these different groups, that the city is actually now not pushing through these crazy things. Granted, they did just push through that like anti-sanctuary cities thing that was stupid.
The resolution.
But they felt
yikes.
Heat for it. They felt a lot of heat for it.
Over 150 emails and 40 people showed up to City Council's public comment.
Exactly. And we're just so well organized now. And I feel like we're really just getting stronger and stronger day by day. You know, DSA is getting stronger. I feel like we have so many more skilled organizers. We defeated 2A. I really didn't expect that.
And for the people at home, 2A was the ballot initiative
yes, to build
for the city.
A new police training facility.
To take
that
some
would have
taxpayer,
been...
extra taxpayer money to build a new police training facility,
yeah, exactly.
which lost like substantially, right?
So, yes.
The
and then the precincts we targeted, it lost by a greater percentage than in the precincts we didn't target. Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, whatever, a correlation is not causation, but I do think that we had an impact, our like grassroots campaigning and the fact that so many different people came together to work on it had an impact. The redistricting that like you and John really like worked on. Mm-hmm. Also, we created a new
that was
the,
a wonderful
the redrawn
thing
districts. We
to
were
watch.
Successful at that
yeah.
because we're so well organized now.
Absolutely. That was a powerful moment for me this past summer. It was the county commission maps that were being redrawn, and we were so thoroughly organized that I saw us, you know, impact like the media coverage.
Yes.
And like that still matters. And
right.
because we did that right out the gate, we definitely shifted the maps to where we were asking them to be in large part, you know?
Yeah.
Which is great.
I'm not used to winning because I've like been a far leftist for most of my life. And so, like, I know when I vote for somebody, they're going to lose, you know? Scribble. But, like,
well,
lately,
we're flipping the script
like,
now, homie.
Yeah, I know,
okay.
Exactly. And it's Colorado
Springs.
It's a
new era.
It is a new era. So I really feel like Colorado Springs itself is starting to change as a result of, like, our effective organizing. In the city and all these, and even like we've been organizing, not me personally, but like CSPC has been doing a lot of organizing around Palestine and getting a lot of new faces
out
in that.
That's the Colorado Springs People's Coalition.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And DSA has been organizing around it as well. So we just see the number of organizers has increased and the skills that they all have has increased as well. And I think people now are feeling more confident. They're like, you know what? Even if the cops do target us, what are they going to do? Like, so what? We know how to fight them now. We can fight them in the streets. We can fight them legally. We can fight them at City Hall. You know, we understand that we can use all
of
these
for legal purposes, not actual assault.
Yes. But like,
I have to say that.
Yes, challenging them in all of these different ways. Challenge, exactly.
Yeah, well said. And I think what I would add there is like, so that means that like we can't stop now. And if anything, I'm feeling incredibly motivated and, you know, our strength is in numbers. And so people can check out Chinook Center on the website, which is
ChinookCenter.org. Or follow us on our socials. Boom. Facebook and Instagram. I think it's just Chinook Center. Just search for that. We're not the mall in Calgary, just to let you know. Sometimes people mistake us for the Chinook Center Mall in Calgary, Canada, but sometimes we get tagged for that.
Chinook Center, Colorado Springs.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Excellent. All right. Thanks, John. I think now we can kind of wrap up episode 2. So I'm going to close this out. So thanks again, everyone, for joining Justice with Jax. We're coming to you from the Studio 809 Community Podcast Space at the Nextus Building, a professional cooperative environment for small businesses in downtown Colorado Springs. So remember to ask yourselves 2 questions. Who is telling your story, and how are you being the change that you want to see in the world today? Justice with Jax signing off.